This is BioSci 385 on Monday, April 27th. As a result of Steve's presentation on Friday with the beast coming out of the skeleton's brain, I thought I'd talk this morning about parasitic ideas. Before I get started, I want to make sure that we've given everybody an opportunity to present. So, Jessica, I think you and Pete, are you the only ones who have not presented yet? Anybody else? Am I right? So we'll do that on Friday. And Wednesday, please come, including those of you who are not here today. Please show up for class, because I want to talk about parasitism in literature a little bit on Wednesday, and then we also need to do course evaluations, and I hope that Elaine and Gabe are doing those this week in lab, which are supposed to do the same thing. So, before I start, anybody have any questions? I'm going to talk this morning about cultural transmission and evolution, which is really kind of a stretch in a way. And I thought I'd use those two figures. The Swallow Barn Laboratory, for those of you who have been to Cedar Point, no longer exists. It's been turned into living quarters. So, that bunch of stuff you're never going to see again. And this thing is really a result of our children. Who we got into a discussion about rap music one time and modern stuff. And both of our daughters are really sort of plugged into modern culture, modern popular culture, by virtue of their jobs. And so here came this flood of stuff. Dad, you need to get this. Dad, you need to get this. And one of them, in fact, constructed a CD with all, and it sent me all the backstory and the history and all that stuff. So that's where that comes from. Yes, I have listened to it. And I'll be darned, on this computer, the animation does indeed work. I didn't realize that. There are two books. This is a reasonably legitimate, and in fact, in some circles, far more than reasonably legitimate area of scholarly endeavor, namely the movement of ideas and the movement of innovations through populations in a manner that is analogous to, in fact, sort of mathematically analogous to and equivalent to the movement of infectious agents through populations. And there are two books that I've drawn on that are pretty good sources of material for this. One of them is a Douglas Hofstadter book called Metamagical Themas. And I would say of all of the books that I own, this one is probably the most important in terms of actually influencing my entire set of thought processes about how I go about teaching and research and writing and everything else. Douglas Hofstadter is a mathematician. He's actually an artificial intelligence guru. And he wrote a set of columns for Scientific American for about 3 years. And Metamagical Themas is that set of columns with a bunch of additional material put in. And there's a lot of stuff in there that is sort of mind-bending. But many of the ideas, and particularly the ones that I've taken right at the end, come straight out of this book right here. Caballi-Sforza and Martin Fellman, Louis Caballi-Sforza, these are two cultural anthropologists, mathematical anthropologists. Both of them have worked on human genetics. They are serious scholars, and if you take other courses in anthropology, particularly upper division ones, you may have come across the name Caballi-Sforza and some of that original literature in those courses. Cultural Transmission and Evolution: A Quantitative Approach is one of the Princeton monographs in population biology, and this is a book that is heavily mathematical. But it's also one of those that is very clear in terms of its the way that it deals with infectious agents in populations. And so a couple of the examples I've also taken from that one. So here's your pop quiz, and go ahead, and if you're taking notes, feel free to write down the answer. And if you, there's also a sign-up sheet being passed around. Make sure, those of you coming, make sure you sign it. And I know that at least one or two of you have seen this pop quiz before, so don't tell the answer. So what do these following items actually have in common? So let's go ahead and write down the answer to that. It's not very difficult. What do they have in common? I've circled one of these because it deals peripherally, at least, with some of the material we've been talking about this semester. I think there's nothing on this list that's particularly strange or unusual or foreign to anybody in class. You've all heard all this stuff over and over and over again. Well, the answer is that they really are items that sort of originate in the human brain, and if they're tangible items such as FUV or compact discs, then those ideas then get converted, or the research and the ideas get converted into tangible items that then tend to move through populations. But they really are entities that originate in humans, and they've moved through populations. And some of them have remained only ideas or words, but in all cases, they have moved through human populations in a manner analogous to infectious disease. And so here's a quote then from Cavalli-Sforza and Fellman, and I'll just read it to you. The first process, growth of awareness, depends on a source. For instance, the makers of a new product. Here you can think of as a reservoir or a person infected with something like swine flu or SARS or whatever, ending up in an airport and coughing and sneezing all over everybody. But you need a source. Makers of a new product, salespeople, evangelical users, transmitters. And so these things right here, radio, journals, TV, these are the transmitters. Second step involves decision, which is motivated by a whole variety of things, economic, emotional, other kinds of factors. So this is really the reservoir. This is the transmission mechanism that will somehow or another produce the distribution of these items in a population. This is the decision. This word refers, or really is analogous to some degree of immunity or susceptibility. If you decide to pick up one of these things, then you're capable of being infected with it. If you say, no, I don't ever in my life want to get a cell phone, then that means you're immune to whatever cell phones bring to the human experience, for good or bad. There's a lot of terminology involved in epidemiology, and a lot of this terminology works just as well for cultural transmission and evolution as it does for other kinds of disease organisms, whether they be viruses or bacteria or eukaryotic parasites. So vertical transmission is from generation to generation downward, parents to children. Horizontal transmission is throughout members of a given generation. So for you all to give things to one another would be a case of horizontal transmission. Oblique really refers to both of them. Host capture is a term that refers to infection in an evolutionary sense from the perspective of the parasite, so that when parasite A decides to get into parasite B or host B or C or something like this, then parasitologists call this host capture in an evolutionary sense, as opposed to the host's point of view, which is I got infected with something. Phylogenetic congruence, where and I have some diagrams here in just a minute. This refers to a situation where the lineages of parasites are the evolutionary lineages of parasites are congruent with those of the host. An interpretation of that, when it's observed, is that the parasites have evolved with their hosts, whether that's a result of an evolutionary arms race or not. Mutation is then the equivalent of innovation. There are analogs then of virulence and infectivity, and I'll come back and talk about those in a minute. Replication with descent, this of course is simply evolution. And the whole idea of something being self-referential is a trait primarily of what we'll call memes here in a minute, or human intellectual constructs. Vertical transmission, here we have, again, my animations seem to be working just fine. So from parent to child, and the different shapes here then really indicate not necessarily different genders, but different sort of degrees of susceptibility. Parent to offspring, and here we have both going on, I think. Vertically transmitted items, some of these things are cultural, certainly religious beliefs, voting patterns, wealth, attitudes about art, music, and literature, reading skills and habits. This stuff is all, to a very great extent, vertically transmitted, just like body lice and Giardia and Toxocara. These Toxocara within the dogs, of course, and I think this is a strict case, or absolutely a literal case of vertical transmission when there's transplacental movement of worms from parent to pup. Use of technology can also be vertical, but that tends to, in many ways, go upward. But in terms of infective ideas, these first five are really kind of the biggies. Horizontally transmitted items include things like clothing styles, peer group language. Those of you who are doing a lot of texting understand exactly what I'm talking about in terms of verbal shorthand, music, old exams. I find very interesting. I've tried very hard to vertically transmit old exams in Bio 101, and it's not seemed to be necessarily, they've not seemed to be very effective in terms of, say, giving a 101 class hundreds of multiple choice questions from which they know they're going to get an exam chosen. And over the years, I kind of wish that I had, 6 or 7 years ago, in retrospect, I sort of wish that I had gone through the exercise of applying for research permit from the Internal Review Board to use Bio 101 students in research. And if had I done that, then I would have carefully documented how many questions out of what they had been given were actually on the exam and when they knew they were given these questions. And it would have shown unequivocally that no matter how many questions, real serious questions that you give to 250 101 students in Hensley Hall Auditorium in advance of the class, and no matter how much they know it from day one, the class average does not change appreciably. It does not go up and up and up the more you give them. Use of technology is also very widespread, horizontally transmitted. But I can also tell you from dealing with, again, your generation over the last 5 to 10 years, that this use of technology evolves very rapidly, then the fundamental nature of how you use it changes very quickly, and your understanding of it as a group. I don't want to insult anybody individually if you may be a world-class hacker, but your understanding of the use of technology and what technology actually is as a group, in my opinion, is declining. You're not very savvy as a generation. So here are here's some stuff that's essentially straight out of your textbook. And for everywhere you see the word parasite in the next few minutes, you can just sort of substitute an idea or an innovation or something that's infected. And so this kind of phylogeny, this is straight out of chapter 2. Now, it's just an example of some hypothetical patterns of descent. Things that are, again, cultural items transmitted by descent. Many of you have inherited or will inherit silver and jewelry from parents, pottery and glassware. When you clean out your parents' houses after they die, all of this stuff will end up in your possession, or you and your siblings will be fighting over it. Trust me, this is going to happen at some time. And if you're smart about it, the older you get, the more aware of this cultural transmission and what's involved in it you will become, and you'll tend to try to take care of it. Stories, furniture, this stuff may be modified, but and stories in particular, as they get passed down. Here's a very simple case of a family phylogeny. Your neighbors might serve as the outgroup. For those of you that have dabbled in cladistics, your grandparent would be the ancestor of your aunts and uncles and all your parents and your brothers. So this is very simply understood. And this is also the kind of phylogeny that might well trace the transmission or the coevolution by descent of all of those cultural items that we just talked about previously. Here's one in which the hosts and parasites are perfectly congruent. And this is one in which vertical transmission over extended time really produces coevolution or co-speciation or co-differentiation in the evolutionary sense. Here's one in which the parasite phylogeny is not necessarily congruent with the host phylogeny. And so the fact that parasite A and B occur in those two hosts, and yet they are their own closest relatives, but their hosts are not their own closest relatives. So this is kind of a simplistic version of or explanation of the idea of non-congruence. And so something's happened here that results in this parasite having captured this host, or vice versa, in a way that's not consistent with their evolutionary histories. Some real-world example, for those of you that know Matt Bullock, are some examples of sort of co-evolution and capture. Here are some bunch of leopard frogs that if there's no X, that means they're susceptible. And here are a couple of species of lung fluke parasites that end up in leopard frogs. And they do just fine, and they are their own closest relatives in terms of molecular phylogeny. They also belong to an entire clade that actually infects leopard frogs. So the assumption was that whatever happened right here allowed all of those species and all of their descendants to actually go into those. Here's a kind of a strange case in which you have species that are their own closest relatives really not occupying the same host. So here are actually green frogs that are closely related to bullfrogs, and these are leopard frogs, so parvoplexus won't go into leopard frogs, and medioplexus will, and parvoplexus will go into green frogs, and and medial plexus alone. So here's a case where relatedness of the infective agents does not match the relatedness necessarily of the host or the place they're going to end up. So let's get on then and talk about some other, you know, kind of go beyond obvious biology a little bit. I think there's not a person in this room that can't figure out that those are a bunch of A's. So this is a picture straight out of Hofstadter's book, Metamagical Themas. And this is what Hofstadter refers to as the letter form problem, which is a study of the way various items actually enter a brain and how they're processed in the brain and how they survive in a brain and how brains sort of interpret them. So there is something about an A that makes you sort of read every single solitary one of those as an A. So this is the so-called letter form problem. And I think that this is one of the most amazing, to me at least, one of the most amazing examples of the ability of kind of related cultural items to get into, to successfully get into a human brain. And we might ask, what features of the brain allow this design to infect it with the idea of an A? And my guess is that you could take the same thing with all the other letters of the alphabet, and you could probably write all these complete sentences in any of these fonts. And you could probably mix those fonts, and everybody in this room could understand exactly what was being said. So we get back to Richard Dawkins, who is the author of one of the really classic books in biology named The Selfish Gene. And for those of you in the room who may have religious tendencies, the fact that I'm drawing on Dawkins, who is probably the world's most atheistic atheist and sort of blastingly so, is really based on the fact that he is also the author, regardless of what you may think of him or his ideas, he's also the author of this really classic piece of literature that I think every biology student should try to read, called The Selfish Gene. So the idea of hellfire is quite simply self-perpetuating because of its own deep impact. In other words, it replicates and is sustained in populations because of its infectivity. It's been linked with a God meme because the two reinforce one another and assist each other's survival in the meme pool. This would be the rough equivalent of a parasite infecting a host, and something about that infection of the host enhances the virulence of that parasite and its ability to actually infect another host. And this paragraph, actually what you could do is substitute the cholera bacteria, the cholera vibrio, that scientific name for what Dawkins is talking about, the idea of hellfire, and this paragraph would apply completely, because there are all kinds of evidence that as cholera infects a population and gets transmitted, it gets more and more virulent. So here is Dawkins' idea converted into the Hofstadter example, and with a sort of a mimic of a little simple computer program. So it's called System X, in which you begin and you end. Blah, 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 blah. It's your duty to convince others that System X is true. And so if you can find something then to make that sentence infective, then this whole system becomes the mathematical equivalent of a virus. And here, of course, Hofstadter draws then on Dawkins' example of viral and self-cancer. Anyone who does not believe in System X will burn in hell, and it's your duty to save others from suffering. And so this particular hook, or this particular infective property, is then what's used by Dawkins and used by Hofstadter to actually illustrate this idea of the infectivity of ideas. self-replicating viral memes, whales are in danger, bourgeoisie is a person of the proletariat, the bill is wrong, etc., etc., etc. Self-replicating ideas are conspiring to enslave our minds. All you have to do is listen to Rush Limbaugh, and you'll figure that out in a hurry. And again, back to Jacques Monod, who is the author, again, of Chance and Necessity, one of the truly sort of important books for all biologists. And I'm assuming that my other faculty members have required that you read this book, as well as Dawkins and a bunch of others. Performance value of an idea depends on the change it brings to the behavior of the person that adopts it. Human group with a given idea confers greater cohesiveness, greater ambition, and greater self-confidence, thereby receive from it an added power. Sure, the promotion of the idea has a capacity to take, infect, the extent to which it may be put over, it's little to do with the amount of objective truth the idea may contain. So here we have some examples of cultural transmission and phenomena from Cavalli Sforza. So this is a heroin epidemic back in the through the 50s and the 70s in Washington, D.C. And these are cases entering Narcotics Treatment Administration in the D.C. area. So what's happening here is that as the number of cases increases, so this is the percent of the patients in here who are addicted to heroin, and these lines for you epidemiological mathematicians are the derivatives of these curves. So these are incidents, which is really the number of new cases per unit time. And so what's happened here is that the idea of substitute of actively providing methadone as a substitute for heroin to addicts simply stopped that epidemic cold in terms of heroin itself. So even though these folks may have been addicted to methadone, what really is happening here is all of the law enforcement burden of trying to stop this stuff and dealing with it is really eliminated by the infectivity of an idea in law enforcement. This is another case of cultural transmission involving 2,4-D back in the years right after World War II, when this herbicide was available and still legal. And so this talks about Iowa farmers and the percent of farmers who were first of all aware of it, and the references to all of this stuff are there in Cavalli Sforza. So these are the farmers who are aware of it, and these are the farmers who adopted it. So this is the this lag time then is the difference between exposure and infection with the idea. Oh, I know about it. Oh, I better adopt it or use it. So this is the sort of some of the mathematical approaches. I actually went back a few years ago and did a little bit of a study of student names in 101, just because they were handy, you know. And there was back in those 2 years is when 101 students first started giving me only their first names on papers. And I'm thinking, come on, Joey, or come on, Melissa. This is not grade school anymore. I've got to have a last name. So at any rate, so then what I actually did was I went through my spreadsheet and made separate sortings of names and according to by first names, and then I started noticing first names. Well, first names are really names that are given to a cohort of people in 101, 18 or 19 years earlier. So something may have been going on. So here we have the students per name. How many students have names captured? And the vast majority of names have captured really only one student, but a few have captured two, some of them captured three, and some of them have captured a lot of students in these various classes. This is essentially what this kind of thing looks like. And dumb as it sounds. So here are some female names from those same things. And I suppose if you actually had done this regularly over a great length of time, you might be able to discover certain events that happened in the past that would suggest people naming their children certain things. So, for example, back in 1999, Jennifer was the biggie, but she disappeared altogether from 2004 to 2005. She appeared again. Really, on the average, the most popular name of all was Sarah, the various versions of it, although Elizabeth comes really pretty close. I do have the guys here in a minute, too. And if you start looking at students captured per name, what's the average? The distribution looks something like this. And here they are. So this is, and you can take a mean of this distribution. And then you can kind of do the same thing with the guys. Pardon me? You are the first Muhammad I have had in class that I know about in at least 10 years. At least. And I'm thinking, that you may be the only one.
Yeah. What?
So here are the guys, and it turns out that the guys' names compared to the women seem to not be quite so effective at capturing students. But if you go through here, and yeah, these numbers here are really kind of low. And if you perform a t-test on these two distributions, you find that the difference is borderline statistically significant. So that by and large, female names are able to capture more students than male names are. At least they were able whenever these things were taken, 18, 19, 20 years before the data set appeared. Here's some additional kind of interesting sort of cultural artifact information. This comes out of World Almanac over the last years. So how many students per computer, okay, in United States public schools? And it really shows you that back in the early 80s, there were a lot of students per computer, but by the middle 90s, there were not very many. So computers are losing their ability to catch students, even as students are gaining on their ability to catch computers. So this is kind of an interesting phenomenon. This would be like, now I'm not sure that I could figure out the appropriate real parasite analogy. Well, the take-home messages then are that ideas, innovations, and so forth can behave very much like, and particularly mathematically, can behave in a manner analogous to parasites. And if you get into that Kabbalah Spores of Buck, you'll discover that it really is filled with epidemiological math. Memes can have infectivity and virulence, and they can occur in endemic and epidemic forms. Their manner analogous to parasites, and they can alter the socioeconomic situations of both individuals and populations, just like real parasites can. And of course, the most effective meme of all is that anyone who doesn't take these two courses next year are going to absolutely burn in hell, and it's your duty to save others from suffering. So I think that's all I have to say. Anybody have any questions they want to ask or comments? Okay, I will see you on Wednesday.